There are fewer than 30 men in the world qualified to drive Formula One. A mere half dozen, perhaps, to win. At this moment, I'm inclined to think you're not one of them.
Thank you to our subscribers and members of our listening audience.
Welcome to F1Weekly.com. My name is Clark Rogers. I'm the host of the program. This special podcast, number 274, is for an exclusive interview by Nasser Hamid with the Grand Prix driver himself, Mr. Patrick Tambay.
Our shout-outs last week, let's get through them now. The podcasters at F1Weekly.com.
And now, another outstanding interview from the guru himself, Mr. Nasser Hamid. And Nasser, this gentleman, and I'll let you introduce him, Formula One career, Grand Prix driver, intriguing personality, and a really nice guy.
Absolutely. This conversation, Clark, is with Patrick Tambay, who spent quite a few years here in the United States. He was Can-Am champion twice and was ready to embark on an IndyCar career when the call came from Ferrari to take the seat of his friend Gilles Villeneuve after the Zolder tragedy of 1982. This is an in-depth conversation in which he shares his memories and thoughts, and I'm very thankful for his time and would also like to thank F1 Weekly listener Mr. Mo Manzoor for introducing me to Monsieur Tambay. These days, Patrick is a proud papa as his son Adrian is now racing in Formula BMW and won actually both races in Barcelona, which was the opening round of Formula BMW. And Patrick also drove for, he made his Grand Prix debut in a McLaren. Then he drove for Renault also. He also did a brief spell with Carl Haas's, remember the Formula One program he had with Lola Beatrice sponsorship. So I'm very thankful for Patrick for his time and sharing his memories with us. And all the best to him and Adrian.
Okay, I'm here in Barcelona with Patrick Tambay. Patrick, first of all, great pleasure to meet you. How are you today, sir?
I'm fine. It's a pleasure as well.
Thank you. Please tell us about your earliest memories of racing and if you had any racing heroes.
Ooh, that's deep down in my brain. I have to put the computer on the research for that. I didn't expect this kind of question straight away at so early in the morning.
I can come back in the afternoon.
Okay. It goes, if you want to go deep, very deep, 1968, Monte Carlo. I live in Cannes, so it was not far away. I used to go there, and my family didn't know. I was barely 18, and took the train to go there and watch Graham Hill, Jackie Stewart, Jean-Pierre Beltoise, and Formula 3 driver François Sever. This is my first contact with motor racing.
Is this a race where Blue Matra was there with Johnny Saros-Gavin also?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, I've been told you are quite an encyclopedia of... yes, this is exactly the race. It used to be the old Bureau de Tabac and the old gasometre hairpin, you know, with the hay stack everywhere. The things have changed a bit since, but this is, in fact, the right race with a Matra engine. I can remember 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock in the morning, the Formula 3 1000 engine revving very high, and the smell, especially the smell of the castor oil racing oil, which used to give me stomach aches. So yes, this is as far as I can go.
You know, you mentioned a name, François Sever. That was the name that I grew up with in 1973 when I woke up to the beautiful thing called Formula One. Question, your first love, I'm told, was skiing, and it was this that took you to the United States. So give us a little downhill on your skiing career, please.
Downhill?
Just going
yes,
down memory,
exactly.
Memory.
It started at the bottom and it took the lift, and then it went downhill. Yeah, I was on the national squad for the hopeful and B team. It was the times where Jean-Claude Killy was the leader of the of this outfit, and it was difficult to be in the top league. I tried it for 3 years and decided that, or I'd been told by my coach that I would not make it to the top, and that I better go back to my studies, which I did. I went luckily back to the States and to at the University of Colorado in Boulder for what turned out to be the best two years of my studies. Unfortunately, or fortunately, I don't know, I stopped to be involved in motor racing in 72, but I keep some extraordinary memories from Boulder as a student. That was, you can imagine, the skiing in Aspen, in Vail, in Breckenridge, in all those ski resorts in the Colorado Rockies, and the studying, and then American girls also, obviously.
That's oh, my God!
That's where I met my first wife, and I have two American kids, so it's America is an important part of my life.
The first time I read your interview in Autosport, that's what you were talking about, living in Colorado. So we're both going back downhill and memory lane. Okay, you were a Can-Am champion in 1977 with Carl Haas. What were the highs and lows of that season?
It was, in fact, two seasons, 77 and 1980. I can only remember highs with Carl and the operation. Carl Haas had a fabulous Can-Am team made of a blend of technicians that came from all over the world, England, New Zealand, Australia, America, and French driver. And it was a fabulous family operation, very competitive, and enjoyed, I think, 6 wins out of 8 races. So that was a good time. I replaced the injured Brian Redman, and that was unlucky for him. But he flipped over at Mont-Tremblant, and I got the chance to replace him. I got a call on the Tuesday evening saying, "Can you fly in tomorrow morning?" I said, "Oh, shit, yes." And the next day I was on the plane and won the race.
Did you ever bring him any Cuban cigars?
How do you know? How do you know that? Yes.
Everybody who follows racing is always smoking, so let's hear the truth.
Yes, in fact, not the first time, because I didn't know that he was such a cigar chain smoker. But in fact, yes, afterwards I always would go to the duty-free shop on the way in and bring him a bunch of illegal, at the time, Cuban cigars.
I think they still are illegal.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
So let's hope nobody from Homeland Security is listening to this interview. Okay, your favorite track in North America, please.
Oh. Well, Sears Point is a nice place, Laguna Seca, but they have changed so much. Mid-Ohio, Elkhart Lake. I would go for Elkhart Lake.
Everybody's favorite, mine too. How about, there are some very nice tracks in Canada. How about there?
Mossport, but it used to be quite a challenge. Mossport, but my biggest memory is linked to Gilles Villeneuve and Three Rivers, and for the general environment, atmosphere, and the Quebec ladies.
Wow.
I go back to that often, huh? I go back to this often.
Yeah, I'm getting an idea. Okay, 1977, you made your Grand Prix debut at Silverstone. How big was the challenge mentally to be in Formula One? And please tell us about the ladies in Formula One also.
That's also part of my career, yes, obviously. They have been an important part of my life as well.
So I don't need to tell this conversation is taking place with a French driver, huh?
Well, I mean, with the old-time drivers, you can. I don't know about the new timer, the new guys. I think they are more maybe reasonable. When you're young, you take it as it goes. You don't. I see drawing back. I see it like I was completely unconscious of what I was doing. Totally unconscious. just it's so hard to get to that position. But I didn't realize it. I was just doing it, and one step at a time, and moving forward, and it was natural. And today, when I reflect on it, I said, gosh, I was lucky and privileged.
Now, you mentioned Gilles Villeneuve. He made the Grand Prix debut at the same time, same race you did. When was the first time you met him? And I know you were friends. Can you reflect on those times, please?
It was in 1976 in the Formula Atlantic race in Three Rivers, where the organizers had taken in four European drivers to confront Gilles Villeneuve's talent to them and to establish his potential. James Hunt was there, I think, Patrick Depailler, I think, Keke Rosberg maybe, I can't remember. I mean, you would probably know better than me. I was there, and Gilles impressed us all, and we got on straight away very, very, very naturally and very openly, and it was very nice encounter, and I cherish that moment a lot today still.
You know, I was reading your interview in Motorsport British magazine recently, and this was so interesting. This was about the time, I believe, he was driving you and his son, Jack, and you were following a rally. Tell us about that, please.
Well, obviously, anything that had an engine and that Gilles was in control of had to be used at 100%. And it was a snowmobile, a motorcycle, an helicopter, or his road car. And we went to a regular rally in the winter time in nearby Cannes. And we were flying in the little back roads, and Jack was standing in the back, holding himself as much as he could, saying to his dad, we were flying, faster, Daddy, faster, faster. So this is the Villeneuve's story.
And in 1978-79, you were at McLaren. How did that deal come about, and how do you look back on those 2 years with McLaren?
Mixed memories, some fun ones and some more difficult ones. 78 was a very good, interesting first season, in spite of the fact that we didn't have, obviously, the best car with the M26, but it was a great team of great bunch of guys, a fabulous teammate, James Hunt, very, very, very good coach concerning the ladies, again. And maybe that's not what you wanted to hear, but in fact, this is the type of memories I have, some interesting moments, but obviously... I had done a choice at the time when I had the opportunity to go to Ferrari at the end of 77, but that's another long story. But I picked up McLaren, and it turned out to be a big mistake in 79. 78 was not too much of a problem. 79, I changed teammate with John Watson, and the M28, I think, was not a big success. It was the first era of the carbon fiber honeycomb combination hub, and it was not the ideal championship winning car, let's put it that way, and we had a lot of problems.
What was the reason for choosing McLaren? I understand you were the one who, once you made the decision, you called Gilles and said, hey, yeah, Ferrari is looking for a driver.
Yes, I was in contact directly with Mauro Forghieri, through Mauro Forghieri with the old man. You can check on that. It turned out to be that the appointment... I was commuting back and forth in 77 between Formula 1 and Can-Am. It turned out that the appointment that we had after Austrian Grand Prix got cancelled because the Mr. Ferrari had a flu or was sick or was... And I went to Charles Stewart, Marlboro at the time, on the Tuesday on my way to the States, and I had a meeting with John Hogan, which was in charge of the Marlboro program, and I told him I was supposed to have a meeting with Enzo Ferrari for joining the team for next year. And suddenly in the meeting, Teddy Mayer turns up. And how strange, Teddy Mayer in charge of McLaren turns up, McLaren sponsored by Marlboro. And we had a chat. I didn't have any agent. I was doing my own stuff. And that was the tendency or the fashion at the time. And he presented me with a contract straight away. And he said, Ferrari will go Michelin next year in 78. It will be probably a technical year, which will be difficult, which it turned out to be in 78. Your teammate will be Carlos Reutemann. It's not going to be such a nice combination. You should team up with James. We are coming out of a winning championship season. It's going to be great, and we're prepared to pay you this. For me, it was big money at the time. And I said, sure, okay, let's do it.
And James was always more fun than Carlos Reutemann.
Carlos is a great guy.
Yeah. You know, he's also in politics, and so are you now in government office. Are you in touch with him? How is he doing?
He's doing great. I always liked and discovered his attitude. And it's strange for his character to actually be in politics. I've been surprised that he was actually in office, but he's done a very, very good job at it. He could have been president of Argentina if he had wished to be, I think, which is very, very strange. But I'm not going to be president of France. Okay. We have what it takes.
Okay. Now, you referred to the ladies a few times. Let me ask you a question. How was Mimi Chao, and where is she these days?
Oh, I don't know. No, I was never interested in my teammates, my friends, or my colleagues' wives or girlfriend. I've always concentrated on my own game.
Yeah, okay. She was very pretty, I must say. Okay, next race, Dijon Prenois, 1979. You were in that race. Were you aware of what was going on between Arnoux and Villeneuve? And have you ever seen anything like that in Formula One before or since?
Oh, yes, we've seen things like that in some races last season. We've seen quite a few, maybe not so crazy because the track was open for this type of stuff. But we've seen some good dicing lately. I can't recall one, but I think last year we had one or two. China was a hell of a race for this respect. And I think it just happens once in a while where you get two nuts which have no fear of anything and will go balls out for it, and this is what racing is about, and this is an historical moment, but we've had a few since.
Is René Arnoux here talking about nuts?
Yeah, talking about nuts. There are a few around, but I don't think those. This one is. I'm not sure yet. Maybe it'll be in Monaco, but yeah, I don't know.
Let me ask you a question, if you know something and if you would like to share. What were the circumstances that he was dropped from Ferrari?
Oh, that's a question for him. I have different ideas, and none of them have been... this is a political answer.
Okay.
The politician answer.
Okay.
I have different hypotheses, but I don't know which one is true. So,
Are you at liberty to share some of those?
They're personal assumptions, and they are not based on any factual elements. So I have to keep them to myself. They're hearsay, but I have my own beliefs.
No, I understand that. Okay, back to USA and Can-Am in 1980, which you referred to already. At that time of your career, since you were living there and studied there, and married an American girl, was there any interest in pursuing an IndyCar career?
Yes. Absolutely. In 1982, after the Formula One strike in South Africa, I came out of the strike on the Saturday morning, and I was a VDS driver planned for the season in Can-Am and in IndyCars at the time. That was the plan. And I had been drafted to go to the Formula One race to replace Marc Soer, injured at Arrows. And I came out of the strike on Saturday morning after all the bullshit went on, and I said I will not drive in Formula One anymore. There's too much going on, which is wrong, because we got screwed. We had agreed to come out on the fact that the super license would be out, and on the fact that we would be cleared. And as soon as we come out and we go back to the track, we hear that the super license is in, and we are fined $5,000. So it was an expensive weekend for me because I got a fine. My airplane tickets from Hawaii to South Africa was not paid by Jackie Oliver. I didn't get my retainer, but I was strong believer that I didn't want to do anything with Formula One. I went back, and I was clearly on a program with VDS and for the Can-Am Championship and IndyCar Championship following that, when Gilles had his terrible accident in Zolder in May, and they called me, and VDS released me from my American program to go to Ferrari.
You refer to the tragic 82 season. Did Gilles ever talk to you about the San Marino Grand Prix that year? The reason I'm asking is what happened once. I was reading an interview with Alain Prost when he was having problems with Senna. And he said, I don't want to get too bitter, because after the Imola race, he said Gilles had called him and spoke like for hours and hours one night. Did he ever talk to you about how he felt, what happened there?
Yes. Yes. It was, obviously we saw each other quite often in the south of France, and he felt that he had been cheated. He felt that he had some values, that he had done his things right for Ferrari at the time with Jody Scheckter in 79, remember, when he could have done probably exactly the same. But they had an agreement, they had an understanding in 82 at Imola in the San Marino Grand Prix. And apparently that agreement was not respected, and Gilles felt very, very bitter about it.
Did you ever get to hear the other side from your fellow Frenchman, Didier Pironi, who became your Ferrari teammate when you replaced Gilles?
Gilles had a very strong relationship with Didier, and I think that Didier felt, I don't know if he did, but as you are asking, he called me on behalf of Marco Piccinini and the Commandator Ferrari in Hawaii, in the States at the time, mm-hmm. to ask me if I was prepared to take over Gilles' 27 car. Mm-hmm. And he never mentioned anything, and it took me a couple of days to decide. After a few phone calls, I came back. I said I agreed. I came back from the States to Europe. And we first had a working relationship and testing relationship in Ferrari. We had two races together, the Dutch Grand Prix and the French Grand Prix. And then we went to Hockenheim. And we didn't talk about anything during those two races and the testing in between. A month later, at Hockenheim, he got very, very severely injured. And we saw each other after that when he was recovering from his injuries and starting boat racing. And never once did we talk about it. I think we had honestly and sincerely, a common understanding of what the real situation was. And we didn't dare... I don't think either one of us didn't dare go into it.
Otherwise, how did you find him as a person?
Well, I knew him for a very, very long time. I was on the panel of his Volant Elf qualification when he became a racer in 73. And I knew him ever since. He was a strong, very strong character, but you have to be in this business if you want to succeed. He was a very self-concerned and motivated, and he had a very huge ego, but yet again in this business we have seen big egos, maybe sometimes bigger than his, but he was very self-confident. But a racing driver, when you put your helmet on, and that's not an excuse, but sometimes you lose sight of the real values, and maybe if he had forgotten the orders in San Marino that day, and he made a split mistake. But I have done one or two myself, so I have to forgive him.
I remember Carlos Reutemann not seeing the signal in Brazil once. You remember that?
No, but at the time I was concerned about my races, not the Carlos races.
No, these things happen, it's sad. Your first Grand Prix win came that weekend at Hockenheim, where Pironi was hurt. What was the mood in the team Sunday evening?
Oof, heavy. Very heavy. The team had gone through a big drama once in Zolder, a few months, a month or and a half before that, and the team was shattered, and everybody was very, very low and depressed. We didn't know in what kind of physical situation Didier was. We knew he was badly, badly hurt for both legs. We knew he was not going to die, but the team spirit was low. I remember one Italian journalist, I think it's Francolini, that came to me and said, you always have been a number two in a team, too nice to go and bite at your colleague and teammate and leader. Now you're on your own, mate. You're on your own, and you got to do the job for the team. And the next day, it turned out to be that, just that.
You know, I read, and it's been reported many times, that first time Enzo Ferrari heard about the Pironi accident, his first words were, there goes the championship. Did you ever talk to the old man about the accident, or what was his mood in 1982?
No, you never talked to the old man about this. You always had contact with him when you were doing the Collado, the testing at Fiorano for lunch or after at the end of the day, reflecting on the new development and the testing. I never had a direct conversation concerning this. The sportive conversation and the technical conversation I had was with Marco Piccinini and Mauro Forghieri, but never any comments from Mr. Ferrari concerning this 1982 championship. We could have won the championship with Gilles, we could have won it with Didier, we could have even won it half season with me. If you reflect on it, it was a crazy season. We won it in spite of all those dramas, Constructors' Championship, but we could have won it three times with the drivers. But I think we had a little bit of a lack of, if I must say today, sportive control of the situation, which got out of hand. The feud between Gilles and Didier should not have existed. It's easy to say afterwards. Yeah. It's easy to say afterwards. But we won the World Championship as a team, as well as in 83. And I think what from 82 and 83 was learned in terms of team psychological, mental, sportive management was the success of the Ferrari team in the 90 era with Michael Schumacher, Jean Todt, and a good, strong number two, and never to interfere, even if it's not legal to do so. But concentrate on one driver and you the other one to take points away from the opposition.
Monza 1982, this is a race very dear to me. I was at that race, my first Formula One race, and I remember seeing you there. You were second in that race. René Arnoux won the race. How do you remember that weekend?
René Arnoux was not a Ferrari driver, he was a Renault driver, but he was under contract to Ferrari for the following year, which in fact was like he was a Ferrari driver. I remember that race well because I had a problem with my shoulder and I had a broken muscle in holding the shoulder blade and the arm, and I had missed the Swiss Grand Prix in Dijon. I had shots of no infiltration in the arm to be able to drive, so I drove this race with only one hand. My right hand was doing the shifting. And Mario Andretti came to that race because we almost had a third injury. We had a third injury, injured driver in the season. And I finished second. I had cortisone anti-inflammatory, anti-staminic shots. I had doubled up size. I had pimples all over. I had a reaction to the cortisone. And I was not in the best of physical shape. But still, the car was a great, great potential. I finished second. And we were on the podium, I think, 1, 2, 3. Mario was third, I don't know.
Third, yeah, he was third.
He was third. So we had three Ferrari drivers on the podium. One was in a Renault overall, but it was three Ferrari drivers.
You know, I was watching a tape of this race a few weeks ago, and Murray Walker mentioned that on, I think, Saturday or Sunday, even though he was driving for Renault, René Arnoux had lunch with the Ferrari team. Is that correct?
I don't know. It's a Murray Walker comment.
He may be mistaken, huh?
It makes a good story, but I don't see at a race meeting something so uncouth to be true. But René could have done something like that. But I don't think it was an official lunch. I don't know if he was. I think maybe he came by. I don't know if it was official that he was a Ferrari driver for the year after yet at that time. I can't remember precisely.
Imola 1983, emotional win for you, driving your friend's number 27 car. Your thoughts and what that victory meant to you and the team at that time?
It's, well, to the team, I think it was a great moment of memory, because they all knew what happened in 82 there. And for me, it was a very emotional moment. I qualified third, the same spot that Gilles had qualified in 82. The fans had drawn a Canadian flag on the spot, saying with a written "Patrick vince per Gilles." You had banners everywhere in on the track. Go for Gilles! Go for Gilles! Revenge! 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 And strange race from third place go to the win, with strange things happening during the race, big motivation, strange things happening to Patrese when he just passed me, when I had some mechanical problems with a fuel pickup in Curva Grande, and the car breaks down on the slowing down lap after the checkered. And I can't make it to the finish line for the podium on time. And Gilles' wife that calls straight away after and say, revenge. Now we can, it's like we can, we don't have to mourn anymore. You know, is I don't know. It's very special.
Yeah, it's a very, you know, when I look back on that season, it's just very mixed feelings, you know, what happened. Dijon Prenois 1984, and I was watching this race again a few weeks ago. Your first pole position with Renault. What was the feeling like leading the French Grand Prix in a French car?
Be on pole there was a very important moment, obviously, for Renault, for a French driver, for French fans, for me. We should have won the championship. We could have won the championship that year, but for a change of regulation, a stupid change of regulation, which created a situation where we didn't have enough fuel to finish the races. We had more power and more fuel consumption. We didn't have any ways of knowing how much fuel we were consuming, where the TAG Porsche engine with Prost and Lauda knew exactly with the Motronic system how much fuel they were consuming, and they could boost down the turbos. So it was a complicated situation. But I think we had the equipment to be competitive, but we obviously didn't handle it properly. So many races leading or on the podium where ran out of fuel, broken throttle, broken cable, many, many technical problems. But to be very sincere, when I came to the grid on pole position at the start of the race, I was so upset with my stomach that I had a big puke. I vomited in my helmet, in my balaclava, just as I took position in front of the starter. So I had it all over my face in my helmet for the whole race. And it was a tough race with Lauda on my back. I had a little bit of a mechanical problem with my brakes. I had to pump it up. And I went wide into a left-hander. He sneaked on the inside, and I finished second, unfortunately.
Your final foray in Formula One was with Karl Haas, the cigar man, which means you are one of probably the only driver who has driven in Formula One for an American, British, Italian, and French teams. Which was the most enjoyable experience? And please, this time, no politically correct answers.
I don't know. It's going to be a totally sincere and honest answer. I've known the way the French teams operate. I know the way the British team operates. I know the way the Italian teams operate. Today, there are German teams also, and they operate in a different way and in a different manner as well. Everybody's got their own qualities and their own weaknesses, obviously. My favorite, obviously, it will be no surprise to you, is the Italian operation. It was very emotional, and I'm an emotional guy. It was very sentimental. So my favorite is the Italian team. It was also my best part of my career. The second best is the English teams. Unfortunately, I didn't have a chance to drive for Frank Williams or Colin Chapman. I would have loved that because they were the most successful at the time, and I would have liked to be able to be part of their expertise and to know how they operate. I was attracted to that, but it never came about. But McLaren was a big operation, but it was not the operation that is McLaren today. A French team, obviously it's a French team. For a French driver in the French team, you have to be, I don't know, it's a period. No comments on that. It was a short period of time, and Jacques Lafitte was clearly the favorite in the team. He had been there for a long time, and everybody was behind him, and the other drivers didn't really count. So for me, it's an erase in my mind situation. But I had the opportunity. Oh, Renault, obviously, it's a constructors' team. I was with a great teammate Derek Warwick at the time, but the emotional participation, the relationship with some of the mechanics was great, but the level of ambition, it was pretty much just a job for them. It was not, didn't have the same kind of total commitment that you find in an Italian team or maybe a British team. But I had the opportunity, like Alain Prost, to drive for Renault, McLaren and Ferrari, and today they are the best.
Yeah. Was Gérard Larousse there? How was your dealings with him?
Yeah, Gérard Larousse was there at the time, in manager of the team in 84. He was not in 85 anymore.
How did you find working for him?
He is an ex driver himself. He had a good understanding of. Of the racing, good expertise. He had the opportunity to lead the Renault F1 project and the Le Mans project for many years. He had the trust of the board, and this is my political answer.
Okay, no problem. Okay, you have finished twice on the podium in the Dakar Rally and also raced at Le Mans. Looking back at your extensive and successful career, what are some of the moments that you really cherish? And if there was one race you could do all over again, what would that be?
Whew. The Dakar experience was something that is really, really counts for me. Le Mans, not so much, but I enjoyed Le Mans in 89 with the Jaguar. It was a good race. We were leading in the night. We had a gearbox problem in the morning. We finished fourth. But that was a good experience. But the biggest emotional human adventure of all was the Dakar Rally. Twice on the podium behind the works team, Peugeot and Citroën, with a non-works operation. Takes a lot of effort from the crew to rebuild the cars at night. Takes a lot of effort from the team on board the car to be shrewd for navigation problem and for endurance capacity, for solving the tricky navigation situation when you don't have all the elements to be able to do a good job, and to share with a co-pilot 3 weeks of grueling times. That was really, really something fun. I also finished third in the Paris to Beijing race, which was just as hard. It was 3 weeks hard work. Totally different from a Grand Prix, where you are alone in your car. You're the last element of a long chain of people working very, very, very hardly for that success. But there it's communion with the elements, with the environment, with your co-pilot, and you share much more important memories, and you can discuss it afterwards, you can share it afterwards. Where when you were a Grand Prix driver, it lasts an hour and a half, an hour and 45 minutes, and you only share it with yourself. And you have to be a very good storyteller, and sometimes people don't believe you. I told you that I had a problem in the 84 French Grand Prix with my brake pedal. Only I know that it's true, but maybe you think, well, this is an excuse. My mechanic can look at the car afterwards, but he's not going to report that we had a mechanical problem. This is the difference.
Now, can you tell us, our listeners, what you're doing right now these days, please?
I try to take my son to the races where he's competing in the Formula BMW European Championship, in the best of mental, technical, physical shape as possible. And this is I'm racing by proxy now, which is a new experience and a very, very intense one. He's doing great. I'm involved in the Formula One coverage of the Formula One Championship for radio network and TV in France. I've been doing this ever since I stopped. So now I have more races behind the microphone than I have behind the steering wheel. So I reflect on all the aspects of the game, tactically, sportively, psychologically, which is very interesting because it gives me the opportunity to understand better our sport, because you have to analyze it. When you're in it, you don't see it the same way. And I am also involved, I'm doing my community work. I'm involved in the local politics for my town hall, and I'm in charge of youth and sports and new technologies. And I'm also in charge for the State Department of our area for road safeties.
Now, your son, Adrian, we're going to talk to him also. He's on pole position here in Barcelona. And I believe he won the race at Road America in last year. Is that correct?
He came to Road America for the two races of the American BMW Championship, and I think he's finished second and third, or second twice, I can't remember. He didn't win the race. Okay. He didn't win the race. He won the last races of the season last year. He won the Rookies Championship, and he's on pole for the first race. Now he has to take the season one step at a time and build up his championship and see how he does. He's in a great team and a great preparation. He's got all the good elements now with him, but he needs to do it on the track.
You mentioned something very interesting mentally when you were talking about your son. How important is the mental, state of mind of a racing driver?
It's crucial. The confidence and the intellectual preparation and the trust you have in your direct environment is crucial. Conflict of personality is not good. You need to feel in total combination within your engineer, your mechanic, and your team environment.
I'll tell you, as a pure racing fan, I love to see the 27, the Tombay name, and pretty much the same helmet design on that for your son Adrian. What's his agenda for next year, if you have some ideas?
Well, we have a short-term plan, which is today's race and tomorrow's race, so one day at a time. We have a medium-term plan. We have a long-term plan. We have plan A, B, C, D. Things are, planned out. They have been for 10 years now.
Good. And, you please tell him that to talk to F1 Weekly and moi when he gets to Formula One.
We'll do the formal introduction at the time, and Great. He'll be happy to do that. Yeah.
Thank you. Now, finally, a message for our listeners, and I'm very pleased to tell you we have listeners in your country also. So if you could say a few words in Francais also, please.
Ben, salut à tous les fans de sport automobile et de Formule 1 en particulier. Rendez-vous sur RMC pour les qualifs et les Grands Prix de toute la saison, comme depuis 7 ans maintenant. Mais je suis certain que si vous êtes sur ce website, vous êtes des connaisseurs et donc vous savez que nous avons rendez-vous sur RMC. Salut à tous.
Merci beaucoup, monsieur.
Patrick Tombé, thank you very much for joining F1Weekly.com.
This is Desiree for F1Weekly.com, thanking you, the subscribers and members of our listening audience, for listening to our podcast, reporting and commenting on Formula One, the highest echelon of motorsport. A blend of technology, tradition, glamour, and guts, all wrapped up in a high-speed package. That's F1Weekly.com for all your Formula One needs.